I'm back. So this is just going to go over the transgender pilot experiences in Houston. Okay, so much of this is already known, but I made a slide, so I'm going to go over it. Male to female transgender persons are a historically high-risk population for HIV. Potential risk factors include unprotected sex, injection drug use, silicone injection, and hormone injection. And previous research has shown HIV seropositivity rates ranging from 8% to 35% for this population. So currently, at this moment, today, there's no, just yet, there's no national surveillance system that exists to monitor the HIV epidemic among the transgender population. But hopefully there will be one soon. And there are limited data on the risk behaviors of trans women, and also limited data on effective methods of recruiting trans women into the health survey research. So we've already gone over the overall objectives for THBS, so I'll skip all that. But just for this presentation, my objective is just to go over the Houston sample, our data experience, and several scales that we added in just in Houston. And respondent-driven sampling, again, so it's all the same as what you've already heard, but specifically in Houston, we had each individual interviewer was paid $20 for doing the survey, because that's what we always give our survey participants in Houston, and we gave $10 for recruiting. And we also started with 3 coupons to recruit, and then we upped it to 5 because we were having recruiting issues. Oh, same thing. Okay, and then this is just an example of an RDS recruitment chain, where you start off with your seed and they get coupons and give them out, and they give them out and people come in, and it goes on and on and on. And like we said before, you know, when you identify your seed, you're looking for somebody who is very dynamic and connected to the community and willing to really promote your study. And we've already gone over this also. Yes, everything's the same as in Houston and in LA, except for the incentive amounts. And then, of course, to be eligible in Houston, you had to be a Houston resident, and then everything else was the same. And you had to be 15, had to be African American or Hispanic, and able to complete the survey in English, and a male to female transgender. We did the eligibility screen. Well, the survey is done with the ACASI, but the eligibility screener is done face-to-face, and this was because the behavioral criterion for the definition of a transgender person can be interpreted very differently, and it's very complicated. So Teresa already went over, but the questions that we asked were, 1, what was your physical sex at birth? Do you consider yourself to be male, female, or transgender? And in the past 12 months, have you ever lived as a woman? And by living as a woman, I mean dressing and presenting yourself as a woman. So the logistics for the field operations in Houston were that we had one field office located in Houston's Transgender Center. And Houston's Transgender Center is really the only one of its kind in the nation. It offers group meeting places, therapy, homelessness assistance, and transition assistance. And it's the largest archive of transgender literature and art. It's also located in Houston in the Montrose neighborhood, which is a Houston neighborhood known for its really open and accepting environment for all lifestyles. We had office hours during the day, and we had, because of the time limitations of the study, we also had huge difficulties in hiring staff because of the way the University of Texas conducts their background checks. So we had a really small staff of me and one transgender interviewer. So that was it. So in terms of recruitment, we had 11 seeds and 48 non-seed interviews. So we ended up with a total of 59 participants. And then this is just to give you a picture of the recruitment in Houston, where we had 6 productive seeds. Number 9 was a really go-to gal. And then 5 completely non-productive seeds, meaning these participants either did not give out their coupons or they gave them to an individual who was just not interested in participating in our study. So this describes the Houston sample in kind of a nutshell. The majority of our sample were African American at 76%, over half were over 30 years old, 71% had incomes less than $15,000, and 80% reported having no health insurance. We had 9 participants self-reporting to be HIV positive, so 15%, but this is likely, we believe, underreported due to some skip pattern issues with the survey that I'll discuss later. Also, we had over half not having been tested for HIV in the past year. Additionally, 29 reported being homeless in the past year, 47%, and 11 said they were current, or 19% said they were currently homeless. So let's get to know our Houston sample sexually. So as you've maybe heard, this was a really long survey with over 100 questions. So I just really picked out some of the highlights of behavior to describe our sample. And because this is a study on transgender women, it can be a little complicated sexually. Only one participant in our sample reported having a surgically constructed vagina. The majority of our sample retained their penis and could potentially have insertive sex. And 99% of our sample had had sex with a man. So because they were born male, they were asked about their first MSM experience, and this occurred at a mean age of 14. The number of male partners, we had a range of between 1 and 150, with a mean being 21. And then looking at last sex for our participants, because this gives the most recent sort of snapshot of sexual behavior, 53% had last sex with a main partner, 76% had receptive anal sex, and of those, 51% used a condom. 20% had insertive anal sex at last sex, and of those having insertive anal sex, 70% used a condom. For drug use, 17% reported ever injecting drugs, with only 7% injecting in the past year. And for our sample, over half were using non-injection drugs, pot being the most popular, followed by crack cocaine, powder cocaine, and ecstasy pills. So for hormone use, hormones can be topical, they can be oral, and they can be injectable. The HIV risk for both hormone and silicone use would be injecting and sharing injecting equipment. So for our sample, 83% had ever injected hormones, and 29% had ever injected silicone. With the silicone use, these injections can be seen as a low-cost alternative to a sex change operation and to expensive hormonal treatment, and they also provide immediate feminization. None of the silicone users in this study got their silicone from a doctor. So the silicone can be injected subcutaneously into your cheeks, your hips, your chin, your forehead, breast, hips, thighs, bottoms, and this can be done often in Houston by an untrained, unlicensed lay practitioner. And this is, of course, not hospital-grade silicone, but industrial-grade silicone that you buy at a hardware store and in an automotive store. So the results can be deadly. Now, violence is recognized as an issue for transgendered women, but questions on violence were added late to our survey, so we really only had 49 participants that were asked these questions. These questions weren't asked in LA or in Chicago, and for our tiny sample, they indicated that physical violence is an issue for our participants, from their relationship partners and from non-lovers, with 49% reporting being hit by a lover, wife, husband, or partner, and 39% reporting physical violence by a non-lover. HIV infection risk can also occur from forced sex, and 22% of our sample reported forced sex by a lover, husband, or partner, or wife, and 24% from a non-lover partner. Okay. So next, I want to discuss three scales. These scales, discrimination, stigma, and internalized transphobia, were added to the end of the core survey. And these were suggested to us by Walter Bakhtin at the University of Minnesota Human Sexuality Program. And they're really just exploratory for us at this point, and we were just excited to have some experience using these scales. For the transgender discrimination, this is a series of 10 yes-no questions focusing on discrimination that trans women in our sample had felt in their daily lives, employment, health services, housing, arrests, physical and verbal abuse. 41 individuals answered the questions, and the overall discrimination score was 3.5, with 0 being no discrimination and up to 10 being the most discrimination felt. This score leans toward the low end of perceived discrimination, suggesting that our sample did not feel any enhanced discrimination due to their transgender identity. But like I said, these are just exploratory. We don't have a comparison group at this point. So I'm just going to present some of the descriptive results that tell us a bit more about the women of our sample. 59% reported that they had problems finding a job because of their transgender identity. 39% had lost a job because of their transgender identity. 88% never had problems getting services from HIV prevention programs based on their identity. 85% never reported having problems getting service from alcohol and drug treatment programs because of their identity. And 85% also reported never having had problems getting health or medical services because of their transgender identity. Okay. The next scale is transgender stigma, and the stigma scale looks at how stereotyped individuals vary in how self-conscious they are of their stigmatized status, and this is called your stigma consciousness, and it reflects how much our sample expects to be stereotyped by others. A low stigma consciousness means that a person is unlikely to worry about how others perceive them, and within the male to female transgender community, you can see how this would be an important measure. So our sample stigma score was a 4. And so again, I just ended up picking some interesting points to describe their viewpoint, with 87% feeling that most transgender people have a problem seeing transgender people as equals. So this would reflect some high stigma consciousness. 66% don't worry their behaviors will be thought of as stereotypical for a transgender person. And this would reflect low stigma consciousness. And 46% felt that being transgender does not affect the way people act towards them, and this would reflect low stigma consciousness. Okay, so the last scale is the internalized transphobia scale, and it's based off of the internalized homophobia scale, and this refers to the personal acceptance or self-hatred that occurs as a result of being a socially stigmatized person. These questions asked how our participants felt in the last 3 months about being transgender, and answered were based on the 7-point Likert scale, 1 strongly disagree to 7 strongly agree. So this scale covers 4 themes: alienation, passing, pride, and shame, and they're used to measure transgenders' internalized feelings of acceptance about their transgenderism. Our alienation score was a 4.5, suggesting this in the sample they did not feel any alienation due to their transgenderism. Passing refers to a trans woman's ability to pass as a biological woman, and the score was 3, indicating a high degree of agreement on the importance of passing in our sample. And this means that passing is important, suggesting internalized transphobia because they want to be seen as a biological female. And on individual questions in this particular theme, 65% thought that passing was everything, and 69% reported that they could not be happy unless they were perceived as a woman. Pride, another theme, relates to a trans woman's internalized pride in her transgender status, and the score of 5.5 suggests a high degree of pride in their transgenderism. In fact, 83% reported feeling special and unique because they were transgender. The theme of shame refers to feelings like disgust and guilt over their transgender status, and a low score would indicate more shame, and our score was 5.1. And in fact, in our sample, 78 reported not feeling depressed because they were transgender. So the overall internalized transphobia score for our tiny sample was 4.6. Just basically suggesting that we really need to do a lot more research in this area and maybe have a comparison group. So that was about it. Okay, so discussions. So looking back through the Houston data and our experience for our pilot, we can say that definitely RDS has potential for this population with some adjustments that we already went over. Even in Houston, the participants really appreciated the ACASI format. We had qualitative evaluations at the end, and everyone really enjoyed the extra privacy and the self-pacing that was provided with the ACASI, but of course they did not like the robotic voice. And then we felt that the eligibility screener was very successful in Houston, and that we feel very confident that our study participants were in fact trans women. So although Houston had the smallest sample size of the three pilot sites, we still feel that we were able to identify high-risk behaviors for this population with a high number of sex partners, low HIV testing rates, and a use of drugs, hormone, and silicone. The high rate of HIV in the sample, 15%, supports previous research that finds male-to-female transgenders as a high-risk HIV population. And then 25 of our 59 participants, 42%, were currently seeing a physician for hormone therapy. And only 36% of the trans women who were negative or of unknown status who were seeing a doctor for their therapy had been tested in the past year. So this really could represent a missed opportunity for health professionals to offer an HIV test to a high-risk individual. Of the women using hormones, 39% were not under a doctor's care for their hormone therapy, and this is also a health risk, as these hormones may be bought off the street and are not regulated by a doctor's care. And additionally, much of our sample reported physical and verbal violence due to their transgender identity. Limitations, we've kind of already been over most of this, but we found, with the survey, there were some issues. There were problems with the skip patterns. For instance, if you did not know the exact number of male sex partners, if you were a sex worker and you said don't know, then it skipped all the sex questions for male partners. And then self-reported HIV risk could be underestimated, because if a participant had been HIV positive for more than 2 years and had not had a test since that first positive test, then the survey skipped that question, and it didn't ask for the HIV status for that participant. So while we had 15% HIV positivity from our total sample, of the participants that were actually asked that question, it was 9 out of 36. So it really would be 25% in our sample as HIV positive. Okay, in conclusion, most importantly, in Houston, a really positive outcome of this pilot would be that Houston, which is a major city, offers much-needed support for male-to-female transgenders, HIV services, medical and health care, the Transgender Center, and health clinics that focus specifically on transgender health. And most importantly, our sample found that these services were accessible and did not perceive discrimination from these services based on their transgender identity. And so we would recommend the further use of the scales I went over, discrimination, stigma, and internalized transphobia, which can provide important insights into trans women's risk behaviors and provide, hopefully, some comparison groups so that we can figure out exactly where we are with this community and guide further HIV and STD prevention and education programs. That's it.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to open it up for questions and discussions with all our panelists. We've got about 7 minutes left in our session here. Let's see, Sel, and then we'll just go across the pink, and then Thomas.
Okay, so I'll try to make this quick. So, first of all, is it Nick McKeel? Because I feel like, you showed that only 29% of people identify as trans women. So the majority of people are not identifying as trans women. And I feel like that kind of supports the point I'm making. I just also want to follow up on that I feel like what people are checking off transgender, because this is really a social role that they're really getting at, that they occupy a certain social role in their neighborhoods and communities from the research I've conducted in New York City. And 10 years ago, if we had asked them what their identity was, a lot of them would have checked off gay or homosexual, because that's how they term their social roles. That's, I guess, what I'm really trying to get at. I also feel that in our study, we did have Spanish language surveys, but we didn't have Asian language surveys, which Tura Nomoto's study at UCSF did. And we had we had 3 years to recruit. We had 100 people and did 3-year follow-up of 275. It was a multi-million-dollar study from NIH. And we had a really hard time accessing certain very vulnerable Asian populations because we did not have Asian surveys. We still recruited about 43, but we didn't get a lot of immigrants. Okay, so that's a suggestion I would make. And then also, I think to really help this population, retrospective data has to be captured. We're finding some very interesting in our with the analysis we're doing around adolescent gender-related physical, psychological, and we didn't measure sexual abuse, but I think that has to be measured because that is also the time that they're forming their androphilic, you know, their high. This is a highly androphilic population that's attracted to men only, and that there's a link there around the abuse and their androphilic identity. And finally, I want to just say, because this is about social justice, I do feel that the joblessness and the job issues that a lot of this population, their problems they're having, has to do with the fact that they're low income people of color. A lot of them are supporting their male partners, who are also low income men of color, and this is a low income people of color issue around the joblessness situation. Thank you.
The woman in the pink shirt.
This is a sort of just an RDS method question in general, and we see that in every RDS sample. You know, the word gets out that there's a study and people are paying, so they show up without a coupon, and we have to explain to them that, you know, this is the way that works and you have to get a coupon. So I think in this particular pilot example, I don't know for sure that, you know, I would be fairly certain that people did approach the study staff and ask them at these locations, you know. And, you know, if, and whether they came back with the coupon, I'm sure that they did. I mean, is your concern that there's like a potential bias there, or are you curious if it just happened?
I was just curious if it happened. Oh. One that we did overseas, we did have a lot of people coming because of our location. I was curious what you all actually said to them.
Yeah. But I think what we normally say is, you know, this is a coupon where, you know, people recruit each other. We don't hand out the coupons. We don't explain to them what the eligibility criteria is necessarily, but you know, we do talk about what community, you know, for what community is being conducted in and why we're conducting it, and you know, that kind of thing. But in terms of our location placement, it definitely, like when we opened those new sites, you know, we definitely were much more visible to the you know, members of the support groups or the computer labs or the youth were, you know, passing their time and things like that. So, you know, I'm sure we got questions.
Now, Thomas, you had a question?
Yeah, a comment and a question. So, well, first, thank you to the CC for finally making a real effort for including transgender individuals in the behavior surveillance. Now, that said, I would disagree with you with RDS works. I think it has a lot of biases right now, 40%, I mean, two of the cities not meeting the goal. And also, I'm not so sure if this is anything different than a convenient sample, right? A lot of the seeds didn't work, and you had to kind of manipulate the seeds and manipulate the coupons. And so, more work needs to be done there. Also, if you're going to be sampling Latinos, come on, the survey needs to be in Spanish as well. That said, my question is, can you speak a little bit more about the trans individuals who are interviewers? Sort of speak a little bit about them. And also, going back to, I think, the person from Houston, you said about, you know, we can't hire a lot of the staff who are part of the population because they have records.
Yes.
And we're facing similar things in academia. So, please.
We just have to figure out a way to deal with that, because I mean, unfortunately, a lot of really qualified, great, connected, dynamic people who would make wonderful interviewers have prior records, and we just have to figure out a way to deal with that. I mean, we had two different interviewers that wouldn't be hired, and I wrote letters on their behalf, and I tried, but It's just the University of Texas policy, and so I don't know how to get around that. But I ended up having one interviewer, and she was a young male, female, transgender, who was, you know, in the community, but she wasn't my first choice. but but you know, I mean, she worked out fine, and it was really helpful to have her there. And then the fact that we were in the transgender center, where, you know, other people were very helpful to us there too. But yeah, I don't know, the hiring thing, we have to figure that out, because it's a huge barrier. But I mean, they would, and if only we could have gotten this one woman hired, you know, just to, if you're hired once in the university, then all these doors open to you to all these other jobs, because you've been past the, you know, the system, you're in the system. So it would have been really great for her. I don't know what to do about it. And that LA had the exact same problem.
Now we have time for one last question. The gentleman in the back.
A really good question. One of your samples, you said their average age of their first MSM experience was 14, mm-hmm. which by legal definition is childhood sexual abuse. So was there any experts that sort of teasing out, because the literature will tell us that those early sexual interactions, particularly whether or not, you know, they identify later on, increases their risk for HIV acquisition greatly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that, I mean, I think that's why that was such an important question. But, you know, it's an anonymous survey, and we don't really look at the results until the end. So we don't really know who was saying when they had that first experience. So we, you know, we can't really offer them any help or anything like that, besides what is already, we make already available to them.
No, I just mean sort of teasing out whether or not they felt it was consensual or forced. I mean, because
for that particular experience? No.
Yeah.
No, that would be really, that's a great idea. Yeah, that would be a great idea. In fact, we see that actually with the heterosexual sample that we're doing now. I mean, we have age at first sexual and first initiation. It's like 10, 11, 12, you know, so it's exactly, and we try and say that, well, let's go with your first consensual sexual encounter, and they'll still stay with it because they, yeah, you know, so, I mean, we see that in every population that we look at for the NHBS and the THBS. It's definitely early initiation of sex is definitely critical.
In Chicago, we use the ACE scale, which is the Adverse Childhood Experience Scale that's been developed by the CDC. It's like a 10-question, 5 different domains of abuse and psychological trauma and things like that that sort of really captures. You know, it's a validated scale, so it's a really nice instrument. We've been adapting it to each population that we conduct these surveys in. So if we do happen to get the opportunity to conduct this survey with transgenders again, we definitely would like to include that scale. So,
it's 10 o'clock. That means that our session is over. I'd like to invite you to come up and continue the discussions and questions with our panelists, and please join me in giving them a final round of applause.